Division will come to order. Today is February 5, 2013. We plan to go until about 10 a.m., perhaps sooner, in recognition of a few of the events that are occurring for days at the Capitol. We have several people that are here to testify for a continuation of testimony on platform priorities by various partners, groups, citizens in our great state. We'll go in order of the agenda, and first we have from Serve Minnesota, Josh Downham. And for all testifiers, state your name for the record, organization, and proceed. And if you do have a handout, you please have them come up to us right now. We do have yours. So, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Josh Downham, and I'm with Serve Minnesota. Serve Minnesota is the state's commission on national and community service. We used to be part of the State Department of Education and are now a standalone 501c3 with a board appointed by the governor. And we were very excited to have Senator Kent recently get appointed by the majority leader to our board as well. We're kind of a hybrid nonprofit government, and we carry out the AmeriCorps program in Minnesota. So we're the domestic Peace Corps. And we have about 1,600 members serving in communities all across Minnesota. And members serve at least a year, sometimes two, of service. And I'm going to highlight two of the largest AmeriCorps programs in Minnesota, the Minnesota Reading Corps and the Minnesota Math Corps. And we work with students struggling with reading and math and help them get back to proficiency. So what I wanted to talk about today, excuse me, is this handout. And our programs use models developed here locally to do interventions for struggling. I'll start with the reading course, struggling readers, age 3 to grade 3. So we are in early learning centers, and we're in schools across the state. We're in about 600 early learning centers and schools. We have 1,100 members who will be doing interventions for 30,000 age 3 to grade 3 students this school year. And what we do is we work with researchers to take a look at the outcomes of our early learners and our K-3 students. And the second slide on this first page is work done by Dr. David Heisted in Minneapolis schools, where he did a match sample looking at students' incoming kindergarten's assessments and found that students that received Reading Corps services pre-K were well above the cut score where they would expect proficiency predictive of a third grade MCA passage. They scored 94, whereas Head Start was at 77.8. And those students who did not have any pre-K work prior to that were at about 70. Much of many of the students in our Reading Corps were actually in Head Start centers, where we go, we train both the AmeriCorps member and the pre-K instructor, and we then serve all the students in that classroom. We also do pullouts within the classroom to help improve some of those students who have even greater needs. I want to go on to the second page of the handout, and I'll go through these very quickly. The first one is the third grade MCA passage rate for students who have gone through our program. And this last year, the 2012 MCA results, we're very fortunate to have a data sharing agreement with the Minnesota Department of Education. So we are able to get MCA data, and this year we'll be actually able to disaggregate that along race and income, and we'll be able to present those data shortly when we get that pulled together. But this year, of those students who went through our program, 80% passed the MCA third grade assessment. Every one of those students to be part of this program were on a predicted track of not meeting that standard. So getting 8 out of 10 over the bar, we're very excited. We're also looking always to improve our program. So we work with the REA departments within school districts to find better methods. And we're finding, for example, many low-income students have difficulty in comprehension. And that's what we're surmising, and what we're piling now are vocabulary interventions to help on the comprehension side of learning. Dr. Heisted also did a match sample looking at Minneapolis students K-3 who received reading core intervention versus the match sample of students who did not. And he looked at what the special education referral rates for those two groups were. And on average, it was reading core participants were three times less likely to be referred to special ed. And so on page three, this top slide shows you the rates of special ed referral and the estimated savings to the state and school districts of approximately $9 million a year. This committee controls the appropriations for the reading corps of $4.25 million a year. We match that with about $2 million, between $1.5 and $2 million private money, and then the federal AmeriCorps dollars as well. And then, Mr. Chairman, I'll finish up very quickly. I know my time's running out. But the Minnesota Math Corps works with students grade 4 through grade 8 who, again, are predicted to be or who are below grade level in their at their respective grades. And on this page 3 bottom slide, at every grade level, the students we work with are making more than a year's growth in a year's time across those grades 4 through 8. You'll see in grades 7 and 8, when the concepts of mathematics get much more complex, we are not making as great a gains, and we're looking at ways of improving our methods for reaching those students. But the last slide on the last page, and this is probably the most telling slide I believe I have, it's the requests that we get from schools for our Math Corps AmeriCorps members. We have 100 AmeriCorps members in schools, 90 schools, reaching about 2,000 students, grade 4 to grade 8. Yet we have over 350, for the coming school year, we have over 350 requests by schools for these services. We can't meet the demand with the resources we have, and this session will be reaching out to you to help improve that. We also have a proposal into the Corporation for National Community Service to augment with federal dollars. Happy to take any questions.
Okay, we'll take one question, and recognizing that we're going to be delving much deeper at a future hearing as we go through the budget, and as you mentioned, you are included in the governor's budget, and as we review proposals coming from the policy committee, but that we very much appreciate your showing the return on investment, the value in test scores and improvement, and so that's appreciated. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Downham, Mr. Chair, you kind of hit on what I was going to ask about, the $9 million of savings for the district. It is small wonder that school districts would be crying for your help, because would it be true that if this had not been in place, you would have expected $9 million to come out of the budget somewhere in order to treat the children that would be then put in special ed, probably?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, correct. The as you know, the special ed dollars flow from the federal government but are augmented by state and school districts because the feds do not pick up the full amount. The $9 million savings, and I'd be happy to present the entire report done by researchers in Minneapolis, but looked at what those interventions or what the, you know, creating the IEP, the work done at the district level around assessment and those kind of things, what were the costs to do that for an individual student. They did do it very conservatively, so that $9 million I would expect to be on the low end of the spectrum of total cost.
We'll take one more question, Senator Dames, and then we'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Donham, can you tell me, with the request being so much higher than the ability to provide the services, what type of criteria do you use in order to determine who received the services? And then can you get me a list of the school districts that are currently being served?
Mr. Yes. Chairman, Senator, absolutely love to do that. In fact, we'd love to have you come out and tour one of the sites. The criteria we use are essentially twofold. What is the need at that given site? So we look at the test score results for that site. And then we look to determine that they actually have essentially enough where our AmeriCorps member will be busy during that whole time. So there are certain sites, particularly on the Reading Corps side, where they may have just too few students for us to keep that AmeriCorps member busy the full time. And we also need essentially buy-in from that site. So a site provides an internal coach to oversee that those AmeriCorps members, provide them with support, and I can get into the full model, but the bottom line is they need to buy in and be part of the team, go through our trainings. And so we have, like as you noted, we have many more than we can serve, and we're hoping to expand that to double from 100 AmeriCorps members to 200 during the next school year.
Thank you, Mr. Donovan.
We'll
get that information distributed. And thank you, Senator Kent, for agreeing to serve on that board. Our next testifier is Pam Wolf from Minnesota Education Advocates, former member of our committee. And she is probably stuck in traffic. So we'll go next to Kate McGuire, Osseo Area School Superintendent. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Kate McGuire, and I am privileged to serve as the superintendent for Osseo Area Schools. With me is Dr. Kim Riesgraf, Assistant Superintendent for Administration. Thank you for providing us an opportunity to speak today. Dr. Riesgraf and I are here to talk about the results we're getting in student achievement and to encourage you around a school finance system that provides stable, predictable, and sustainable funding over time. While we'll be giving you some specific examples of why this is important to the practitioners in Osseo Area Schools, we know that the issues we're addressing are common throughout Minnesota, and as members of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, we'll speak to those broader interests as well.
Excuse me, Superintendent, in case not all members or listeners are aware of where Osseo and the schools, can you just give a geographical perspective?
Thank you. Osseo Area Schools serves the northwest suburbs in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. So we take in the communities of Brooklyn Park, parts of Brooklyn Center, Maple Grove, Brooklyn Park, Plymouth, Dayton, Corcoran, Rogers.
Thank you.
Osseo Area Schools boldly declares as its mission to inspire and prepare all students with the confidence, courage, and competence to achieve their dreams, contribute to community, and engage in a lifetime of learning. All students in our school district is no small task. We are the fifth largest district in Minnesota, serving more than 20,000 students in those northwest suburbs. Here's what sets us apart from other large suburban school districts. Half of our students are students of color. We serve the third highest number of students of color in the state of Minnesota. We serve the second highest number of Asian Pacific Islander students in Minnesota. Here's why that fact is important to your work this session. I believe that if we can shift the racial achievement gap in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Osseo area schools, where more than 28% of all students of color in the state are served, we can shift the face of the racial achievement gap in our state. The key to accomplishing this goal is to ensure equitable student achievement. And that means that we ensure high levels of learning for all of our students, we accelerate achievement for students of color, and close the racial achievement gap. I want you to know that Osseo Area Schools is getting results that are leading to these kinds of equitable gains in student achievement, that we know what it takes to get these kinds of results, and that equitable achievement gains require stable and predictable funding over time. Let me give you just three examples of the results that we're getting that are leading to equitable student achievement gains. On the back of your handout, which I believe you already have for our school district, you'll see these three examples.
Have your handout?
They don't seem to have my handout.
Okay. Yes. Superintendent, yes, we'll distribute that now. Thanks for the prompt. Continue.
Would you like me to continue?
Yes.
Okay. One of our key indicators of results is student proficiency. Proficiency means the percent of students who meet or exceed the standards that are set by the state.
In reading from 2008 to 2012, all student groups became more proficient, and we saw large increases of 8 to 12% for students of color, which means that we're making progress in closing the achievement gap. All student groups are doing better, and students of color are making accelerated growth to catch up to their higher performing peers. The second data point shows evidence of success is that more of our students are graduating on time. Our on-time graduation rate for Caucasian students is already very high. Over the past 5 years, more of our students of color and more of our students of poverty are graduating on time. In fact, the rate of on-time graduation for our Asian Pacific Islander students has increased by 9%, and the rate for our Black students has increased by 12%. The on-time graduation rate for students in poverty has increased by 6%. I have one more powerful piece of evidence of results related to graduation rates. This example does not show on the chart on my handout because the cell size is too small to be reflected by MDE. But our American Indian students, while they are small in number, they are graduating at rates higher than the state average for this group. For the class of 2011, the four-year graduation rates were slightly higher than the state average. But the five-year graduation rate for our American Indian students in Osseo was 88.9%. 88.9% for our Native American students. This is over 30 percentage points higher than the state average. A third way that we measure equitable gains is by looking at opportunity. How many students are taking advantage of the most rigorous coursework that we have available to prepare for post-secondary education or career? Over the past 5 years, student participation in college-level advanced placement and international baccalaureate courses has doubled. The increase in participation among students of color over that same period of time has tripled. The number of our advanced placement scholars has more than doubled as well. We know what it takes to get these kinds of results in equitable student achievement gains. It takes a shared vision for all of our children that has equity at its very core. It takes early learning, including preschool and all-day kindergarten. It takes a safe and healthy learning environment. It takes effective instructional practices that continually improve to meet the contemporary needs of our students. These practices include standards-based instruction, assessment, grading, and reporting, which require teachers to work together to develop common assessments and to allow students multiple opportunities to demonstrate their performance on a standard. It takes research-based instructional strategies proven to have a high effect size, culturally responsive curriculum and instruction, specialized programming like AVID to support underserved populations in our most rigorous courses. It takes the examination of data in teams. It takes timely and individualized intervention in behavior and academics when students are not meeting our highest expectations in both of those areas in order for us to reduce racial predictability in our suspension rates and to increase student achievement. It takes opportunities to thrive in specialized programs or elective courses that meet the individual interests of students. We know that it takes coaching and professional development that's embedded in daily practice, but most importantly, it takes teachers in classrooms with class sizes that are conducive to them building the kinds of relationships that it takes to motivate students to learn, and instructional support staff that can surround those teachers so that they can do their very best work. The programs that you've been hearing about, for example, Mr. Downham spoke about the Minnesota Math and Reading Corps. We have Minnesota Math and Reading Corps in our school districts. We're one of those school districts that is a beneficiary of those kinds of wonderful services and interventions. Those kinds of programs that you're learning about that have an effect on student achievement will be most effective when we have the numbers of teachers that we need in classrooms to build relationships with those students and to help design those interventions. We're getting results, and we know what it takes. Now, over the past 5 years, Osseo Area Schools has reduced $16 million in expenditures and implemented cost containment measures of more than $800,000. Last November, our operating levy failed by 120 votes out of more than 68,000 votes cast. As a result, we're planning for $11 million in budget reductions over the next 2 years. That number will climb to more than $14 million if we don't get the same amount of integration revenue that we currently receive. Reductions will impact the very things that I just explained are critical to the results that we're getting for students and will make it difficult to accelerate academic gains to close the racial achievement gap. Osseo Area Schools, with the third highest number of students of color in the state, will be reducing support for the very practices that are helping us get equitable student achievement gains, and we need your help. I've asked Dr. Riesgraf to share very briefly a few specific items from our legislative platform to help you understand the kind of impact that you can have.
Thank you. Dr. Riesgraf.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we would like to encourage the legislature to allocate resources through understandable statewide formulas that rationally relate to educational needs in order to increase achievement for all and close the achievement gap. Some of the specific points that we would like to have you support and endorse is providing funding to reduce the amount districts must take from their general fund to cross-subsidize special education. To link the basic formula to an annual inflationary rate to provide sustainability for our school districts. To reform compensatory funding and integration revenue as recommended by the MDE Education Finance Work Group. To continue to strengthen programs like QComp that we've been able to take advantage of in our school district and to use that same kind of structure to help with the principal evaluation system. To implement the new principal evaluation system with those kinds of supports, and to provide school boards the authority to renew existing levies when they expire, and then lastly, to fund voluntary all-day kindergarten and access to quality early childhood programs. We're using our Title I dollars to provide preschool programmings at three of our Title I schools, and we've seen phenomenal results. So early education is one area that we really think matters.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your kind attention and for your service, and thank you for the opportunity to share this information. We're happy to answer any questions that you might have now, and we also hope that you'll call on us anytime that we might be of assistance to you on things that impact teaching and learning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we're not going to take any further questions so we can get through the testifiers and a couple of other events that are occurring. We will be revisiting all of these topics, and many of the testifiers are setting up individual meetings with us as well. So this is in preparation of further exploration of these topics. So thank you very much. And we'll ask you on the legislative recommendations if you could state those as well. We have seen elements in various platforms, but if we could have that for our record. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just requested the list. I thought it would be good for us to have those requests because they're very consistent, I think, among districts. We're hearing the same message, so it'll be good for us to collect the recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Pam Wolf. And I mentioned, Ms. Wolf, that you formerly were a member of our team here at the table, and welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I apologize for being late. Apparently, it takes, whether I leave my house at 8:30 or 7:30, I get here at the same time. Traffic is a little heavier to go 15 miles this early, so I apologize for that.
No.
I'm Pam Wolf. I am here advocating for Minnesota Education Advocates. And to those of you who are in the other education committee, I apologize, you're going to hear a repeat. For those of you who do not know me, I have been a teacher for 26 years. I've taught in public school, ranging from kindergartners through super seniors, special ed, regular ed, health, PE, some social studies, temporarily some math, a variety of different subjects over the years. And what this group is it's a group of educators and parents and other community members who all share the same philosophy when taking a look at education policies and funding practices and reforms, and basing those decisions and evaluations on four principles of student success, fiscal responsibility, local control, and is it a practical policy? And so taking a look at each of the current practices, policies that exist, as well as ones that are being proposed this year, and looking at whether or not they fit into those four principles. And I want to say, Mr. Chair, I appreciated that you asked for bullet points. I love bullet points. So what you see in front of you is just some real simple bullet points of what the principles are, what it is that the group does. We analyze, as I said, then we will advocate for reforms, funding, and legislation that will promote those four principles, and then we will inform our members and the general public as to what how we think that policies that are being proposed relate to that those principles. And I just listed a few priorities. We are not obviously limited to those as things come up, but I really don't have any other input for the education advocates. I know it was more of an introductory testimony, not a specific issue or, you know, topic that's going to come up. My background and where this started from was about 10 years ago. I've been thinking about this for at least 8 to 10 years. I taught in one school district where, and again, I apologize to those of you who already heard the story, who on the last day of school, it got to be the end of the school year, and we had some money left in one of the categories of money that school districts get, and it was decided that we would buy new desks and tables for the classrooms. Teacher got to say which they wanted, desks or tables. And so on the last day of school, they took all of the desks out of the building, brought them to the back parking lot, and smashed them and threw them away. And that just made me sick to my stomach of what a waste that was. And I had asked, you know, couldn't we sell these to, you know, another school district that maybe can't afford? Because they weren't all in horrible shape. Couldn't we give them away to families who maybe would like a desk at their home for their child to study on? And I was told that, no, the law, the rules would not allow them to do that. And so that was my first taste at this compartmentalized system that we have of how we fund things. I thought it would have been more practical if they could have just bought, you know, a few desks or tables that they needed, could have put the money aside for next year when they needed to make a bigger purchase. It just didn't make sense that we would be getting rid of things that there weren't more options for them to do. As well as there was a number of teachers like myself who had some frustrations with how we were represented when it came to various education issues. And so I'm here as a voice for those teachers as well. And I'm here as a teacher, as a multiple topics, as a coach. So if you want to use me as a resource, I'd be more than happy to be used that way, as well as voicing the opinions of the group.
Thank you. And Ms. Well, for clarification, is the MEA, Education Advocates, are you an incorporated or a nonprofit?
It's a nonprofit,
governing board?
501c3.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm not a paid lobbyist. I am here voluntarily. So that's why I appreciate, Mr. Chair, that the website has the information, because I rely on that to know what's happening down here.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Well. Next, Mary Ciccone from Parents United.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me,
members.
Ms. Ciccone, are there handouts?
I'm sorry, there are.
Okay.
For those
you have
of
an
you,
excellent website. We know that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Ciccone, and I'm with Parents United for Public Schools. And because I was just in front of the policy committee, I thought I'd change it up a little bit and give you our brochure rather than the bullet points. But Ms. Elling has a link to those principles that are on our website. This is very exciting. Parents United for Public Schools is a Minnesota-born, parent-led, statewide nonprofit focused on E16, having the best possible public schools. We're 10 years old. We're run by a board that is purposefully as diverse as we can make it geographically, socioeconomically, and racially. They are actually setting up individual meetings with each of you because they wanted to introduce themselves to you. They are all parents. Because I think funding is such an important issue on who's on this side of the table advocating to you, I want you to know that Parents United funding, all of our funding, half of it comes from individual donors, parents who support our work, and the other half is given by foundations who are funding us to do civic engagement. We help parents understand how state and federal legislation impacts their local schools. We help parents by providing analysis of proposed legislation and track it using the evidence and the research of its efficacy in helping student learning. We help parents understand the legislative process. It can be very oblique unless you're actually watching this on a daily basis. And we produce weekly legislative updates to share this information, and we send it to 5,000 people in all 134 legislative districts. I have done over 400 presentations in all parts of the state on how schools are funded and how they're governed. My personal background is I've been a teacher, a licensed principal, and a school board member, but always and forever I have been a parent advocate. We also help parents provide the parent perspective at state-level task forces. We have advocated for and been successful in getting parents on the teacher licensure task force, the teacher evaluation, principal evaluation, finance working group, assessment, and accountability. And if I could just tell you one little story, I'm not sure if you know about Sapeo in Minneapolis, but it really helps folks who tend to be low-income understand how to navigate the school system. Actually, one of the coordinators is a board member of ours. And so one of those parents had gone through that process and learned how to help her child do well at the school, but she said, I want to go further. So we advocated for her to sit on the assessment and accountability task force at the state level. So she was there providing a perspective from a parent who had a low-income child who was struggling in the system. So that was like very exciting for us. We try and provide a statewide perspective to locals and help the locals understand how to get their perspective up to the state. We don't speak for parents, although we often share what we're hearing because we hear a lot from them. But we do provide the information for them to have a better conversation with you and also with their local school officials. And, Mr. Chair, thank you for mentioning the website. We have been touted around the state about having one of the best websites that's most accessible for people to understand the issues around education. We'll be here. We'll track exactly what's happening and share it with your public so that they're able to have better conversations with you. That's the intent. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ciccone, and on behalf of the committee, we appreciate your efforts in going around. You're like a missionary throughout the state on behalf of education, and the website is outstanding for members that want to get a very good historical background on school funding and related issues. Check it out. It's nonpartisan, and I would highly recommend it. Thank you. Next, we have Linda Sandvig, and she may have two hats today. I'll let her tell us if that's the case. School Nurses of Minnesota and the School Social Workers and also Literacy Action Network. So, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Linda Sandvig, and actually I'm wearing four hats today, but one will be very brief because I also do some work for St. Paul Schools, but Mary Gilbert was here already testified, so you know pretty much as far as what St. Paul Schools are looking at. So the hats today I'm going to be looking at is Literacy Action Network and Minnesota School Nurses and School Social Workers. Minnesota Literacy Action Network is actually ABE programs, Adult Basic Education programs throughout the state. There's 46 consortium throughout the state. A lot of districts have come together to provide more efficient services. And just so that you know, adult basic education, even though we're focusing on adult learners, is part of the K-12 budget. So that's why I'm here. Although I would say that One of the benefits of being part of the community ed program in school districts is the flexibility that we have, that our programs focus on ESL learners, GEDs, adult diplomas, basic skills, workplace. So we are able to address a lot of the needs in the different communities. For example, in southwestern Minnesota, in Marshall, they have more jobs than they have workers. So one of the things that was looked at was a welding program, and through the adult basic education program, they were able to partner with employers and provide a certificate program for those individuals. In other parts of the state, we know ESL services are huge. We've heard that in Rochester, certainly in St. Paul, a lot of the different districts as far as looking at those, and we have the flexibility to provide those services. Basically, as far as looking at kind of our legislative agenda, you have handouts on that. One of the issues that we'd be addressing is trying to restore funding cut that we had in the last biennium for adult basic education programs. Unfortunately, we were one of the few we were the only program in the education that was cut last time. Just to tell you a little bit about our funding. Our funding is based on what we did a few years ago, which is maybe different than you'll hear in K-12 about the different parts of the funding formula, is we found there were different needs throughout the state. There were some areas of the state where they definitely needed programs but didn't have a lot of learners. But if that program were to close, there would be no access for folks. Other areas of the state were busting at the seams because of new immigrants coming for our programs. And can I just mention, and I hope she won't be embarrassed, but we do have a graduate at the table of our ESL program in Minneapolis, Senator Tories Ray. So, you know, that is looking at the variety of services that we have. And basically looking at a formula, we came up with a formula that looked at how do we preserve access throughout the state, and then how do we deal where different pockets of the state are having increased demand for those services. And so that funding formula was put together probably about 10 years ago, and you will not see anybody from basic education coming here asking to change that formula. However, how it was based is it's based on population, it's based on ESL learners, it's based on adults without diplomas as part of the formula to stabilize, but it's also based on contact hours. And the contact hours are based on services that are generated and increasing new learners. Unlike K-12, we don't get specific funding based on having new learners come into the program. And so what was put in was a growth factor, and that growth factor was reduced from 3% to 2%, and it's a permanent cut going forward. And so as we're looking at more workforce development type of issues, as we're looking at immigration reform and things like that, we're looking at that we will probably have steady clients and to do outreach and to do more intensive kinds of services. So that would be something we would ask you to consider in this budget. The second issue that we have, we think, falls with a lot of the discussion right now that's being talked about the redesign as far as transition, as far as post-secondary. A lot of that is focused more on, I would say, more traditional learners than looking at adult learners going maybe non-traditional paths. And so the proposal that we have as a policy one is creating a statewide diploma program. Right now, there are some districts that Rochester, for example, offers that program. But it's only for that district, so it is not portable. One of the things that we are finding with the GED is that test is actually administered through a private company. The costs are going up with that. For a lot of our learners, that's the equivalent of a high-stakes test. And so we're looking as far as the alternative with the adult diploma that would look at competency-based and looking at what adult learners do bring to the table that can bring them looking at as far as certificate programs and things like that. The other thing that's happened is the federal government for Pell Grants right now used to accept if you could get into a program, would do that. Now they require a diploma or a GED. So learners that do not pass the GED are kind of dead-ended. So our proposal this year is to set up a task force to develop that diploma that would be statewide and portable throughout the state. We'd look at working with ABE providers, higher education, and business to develop that. That does not have a cost. We look at that there's funds within ABE. There's a 2% for supplemental services, and that would go to looking at expanding that program. Going off into the next two groups with school nurses and school social workers, you'll find that on their platform, they share a couple of topics that they are very interested in this session. One would be as far as looking at bullying prevention legislation. Both groups follow the governor's task force and so are eager to see the bills coming out on that. But we definitely feel for both school nurses and school social workers that there needs to be a stronger definition as far as what bullying is in Minnesota state statutes. The other issue that they are very supportive of is the expansion of school-linked mental health services in dealing with that. Obviously, those are services that would be funded through Health and Human Services and in the schools. We think that's a vital link, but we would like to just add that we believe that when you look at mental health services, it's a continuum. And obviously, there's pupil support services besides nurses and social workers, psychologists, chemical dependency, and counselors that are providing those services. And when we look at both the bullying and we're looking at safe schools, we really see that we would like to see additional funding to support a whole cadre of those services. We also support that we think it should be up to the local school district to decide the mix as far as pupil support services, that it really depends on the needs in those students, in those schools to look at that type of thing. The other issue that has come up, particularly with the school social workers, and we think should be part of the discussion with mental health, is one of the things is school districts are required to bill for health-related third-party reimbursement. And that has been something that we are trying to chip away with the school nurses. We worked on getting on applications, consent, and things like that. That took a long process, but we were successful last year, so we are emboldened to try next as far as mental health services. The process that's in place, we feel, is kind of duplicative with what you have to do through IEP services and then what you have to do through the CTSS, which is through DHS. I think you will find that there, when you look at healthcare and education, that there's some common practices, but we may use different jargon in both. And so what has happened in the mental health services, when you look at skill training and diagnosis and things like that, is there's maybe kind of parallel processes, but we look at different terminology with that. And we know, and particularly this is also on St. Paul's legislative agenda, we have a lot of kids with EBD, and we think that we should be having the health budget pay for those services rather than looking at general fund school dollars. So that is something that we would look at as highly important for this legislative session. Just a couple of other issues as far as school nurses. School nurses, lots of times proposals come up as far as looking at what we can do in schools for health services, and we absolutely think that's an appropriate place as far as looking. But we also look at some of these are unfunded mandates. So one of the things we've heard that there's interested in some as far as EpiPen legislation, that school districts might voluntarily have EpiPens, and they could be used for students that don't bring those or those that have reactions in school. And so we're having some discussions with that. Again, we look at trying to look at kids' health care needs, but we also have to look that we can't just shift health care funding issues onto the schools either. So we want to be mindful with any of that kind of legislation. We're also aware of some legislation that would increase the funding for early childhood screening, which is kind of another unfunded mandate, but we think is really important type of thing as far as screening for kids and getting them ready for school. So that would be one other issue. One other issue that I just want to do, and I realize it is not part of the education, but just to know that we really look as far as school nursing, that if you have, that we envision student health for student success. And so really when we look at the medical assistance expansion, that is a huge bonus as far as looking at kids and covering kids better under medical assistance. Because in education, we talk about the achievement gap. In healthcare, we talk about health disparities. And guess what? The populations are kind of the same in that. Kids that don't have access to good medical care and things like that are going to be, it's going to be difficult for them to be successful in school. So the Medicaid expansion would include 106,000 people, and many of those would be kids that would be covered under Medicaid instead of Minnesota Care, which is a much richer benefit set. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Sandvig. Is there Ms. Pfeffercorn in the room? Welcome to the committee. Thanks.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Already you've heard so much information, and it's only 9 o'clock, but I really appreciate your time. And I also want to thank you because I'm one of the community members that missed the first financial test.
Ms. Pfeffercorn, just say your full name and for the record. Thanks.
Marika Pfeffercorn with the African American Leadership Forum.
Thanks.
And again, I just want to thank you for inviting us back again to have an opportunity to really present our support for much of the work that you're going to be doing this session, as well as encouraging you to pay particular attention to several of our legislative agenda items. So let me just tell you a little bit about the African American Leadership Forum. It is not the representative body of all African Americans in the state of Minnesota, but it is a collective and network of individuals that are advancing and supporting the ideals of the African American family and successful outcomes for families in the state of Minnesota. And through the policies that we hope to either expand or pursue, we really hope to work in cooperation with this committee. And again, I thank you for your time. So the one thing that I want to start out with is in our effort to identify and address the needs of African-American families, when we really put in place supports for African-American families, there's a noticeable trend that all families are actually impacted when we have families that are successful. So therefore, I want you to keep that in mind as we're talking about the policies that we're talking about today. So one of the things I would like to also let you know is that I have a background in education, youth development, and higher education. So I've worked the spectrum of education from preschool programs to working in St. Paul, Minneapolis Public Schools and also working at the U. And in that experience, there's been so much research about early childhood programs. And so we really want to promote the idea of a all-day kindergarten for all in the state of Minnesota. And in addition to that, and really helping to support our working families, it would be a universal preschool so that we could also have qualified and certified teachers that are supporting our young children in their early development in reading and cognitive development. In addition to that, we are also looking for the funding structure that you use in deploying funds for young people. We ask you to take a step back and take a more comprehensive look. At the end of the day, it oftentimes feels like our students are competing for attention of the funding. And therefore, when we think about the definition of education, we really want to expand it to think about our out-of-school time opportunities that we have. We have our early childhood. And so when we have streams that are specifically tied to education, oftentimes out-of-school time programs are left out of that process, and even when they're working in collaborative partnership with education entities. I would also like to say that for the K-12 that we are looking at reinstating a lot of the funding that has already been cut and supporting education policies across the board. And so I don't want to take up much of your time this morning. I wanted to briefly introduce our organization, and we will be scheduling individual meetings with many of you. I am the chair of the policy committee, and this is actually my first meeting, and I was just identified as a testifier last night, so please excuse me if I'm a little nervous. But again, I really appreciate your time and your attention to this matter, and that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Pfeffercorn. You did a fine job.
Thank you. I can stop shaking now.
I believe we have one more presenter. It's Kenneth Eben. Sorry if I mispronounced your name. Welcome to the committee. And if you could just have a seat and introduce yourself to the committee. And do you have any handouts for?
No, I don't.
Okay, that's fine.
All right. So my name is Kenneth Eben, and I am a sophomore at the University of Minnesota. I'm also part of a student group called Students for Education Reform. I'm 20 years old, and I just voted in my first presidential election last November, And I'm excited to be here today because this is just another chance for me to participate in the political process. And I want to do so by sharing a story of myself and the story of a friend of mine. So I am a political science major at the University of Minnesota, and I actually, my interest in political science started when I was in fourth grade when my parents were taking the citizenship test and studying for that. And my parents, being from a different country, knew the importance of a high-quality education, and they wanted to make sure they put me in a safe and secure place to receive a high-quality education. Because for kids that look like me, African-American, they know that it is a lot harder to succeed in this country without a high-quality education. And so they fought desperately to make sure that I received one. And so I went to high school, and I realized that when I was there, kids didn't really look like me. There weren't a lot of kids of color there. And I started asking, why is this? What's the deal with this? But I didn't really truly start thinking about these questions until I was a sophomore in high school, and that's when I took the practice SAT. When I took the practice SAT, I scored fairly well. It wasn't anything outstanding, but it was still pretty good, and I was happy with my score. But a few weeks later, my principal called me into her office, and I was thinking to myself, I don't know what I did. I hope I'm not in trouble. But she actually was telling me that I had won an award. And I was happy. I was like, for what? And she was like, because you scored in the top 3 percentile of African Americans in the country on the PSAT. And I thought, this is great at first. Like, this is something I'm really excited about. But I started thinking about that. And I mean, when I initially got my score, I wasn't ecstatic about it, and it wasn't anything like completely noteworthy. So I was wondering why I had received this award. And it made me think about, am I being measured on a different scale than other students because I'm African American? And what does that imply about the education system if they're setting different standards for me? So now I want to tell you the story about my friend, another student in this student group on a different campus at Metro State University. Her name is Tasha Gandhi. She graduated from Arlington High School here in St. Paul, and she was at the top of her class. Unfortunately, due to like a messy relationship, right after high school, she got pregnant and had to support her family, her new family, and had to go to the workforce. When she was in the workforce, she realized that she couldn't really get a promotion because she didn't have a college degree. And she also later got laid off from that company because she didn't have a college degree when they were going through her layoffs. And so she decided to go back to school and go to college and earn that college degree. But unfortunately for her, she felt tricked when she went to college because she had to go to these remedial courses. And in those remedial courses, she didn't feel prepared, even though she was at the top of her class when she was in high school. But thank God that Tasha's a fighter, because now she's a senior at Metro State University with a 3.9 GPA. And her greatest motivation are her two children. Her oldest goes to a Title I school. And at that Title I school, she's struggling with reading. But unfortunately, she can't get the support she needs to help her improve. Her youngest child is extremely bright, just like Tasha, and tested in to kindergarten at the age of 4. But Tasha can't afford to send her 4-year-old to all-day kindergarten. There are tons of stories like mine and Tasha's in our student group across the state called Students for Education Reform. Our stories and our students are just as diverse racially as they are with their experiences. Our leaders across the state, we have a 70% of our leaders are students of color. And we think this is important because we have people representing and telling their stories and advocating based on issues that they saw while they were in school. And so we know the power of organizing ourselves and organizing students to create change, because we are the products of the system, and we know how to organize ourselves. We organized a rally last fall that brought out 350 people, students, community members, community leaders, and even a U.S. congressman, to talk about what it really means to uplift education in the state. We have these postcards that everyone filled out on why they think it's important to uplift education. Also, we organized a Minneapolis school board forum for the candidates to talk about why they think it's important to change the education system and what they see for the vision of Minneapolis public schools. We were told by those candidates that our questions were the most rigorous questions they received during their whole election season, because they came from our experiences and what we saw needed to be changed in the system. We believe as student groups in the statewide movement that we need to have policies that are focused on student achievement and supporting the classroom. And there is in the education system currently, it's not serving a large number of students, predominantly low income and children of color. And we have to do whatever is necessary to educate our kids. We are encouraged by the governor's budget proposal and how much money it is bringing back to the schools. But we also know that we need to see systemic policy change, because we don't think putting money into the system is necessarily fixing that system. We also understand that poverty is difficult and it needs to be recognized, but it can no longer be used as an excuse to not educate our kids. We have a huge opportunity for an entire school day to give kids a safe place to receive a high-quality education and truly live out their dreams. So why I'm here today is to tell you that there are students across the state that are watching and going to be holding you accountable for your decisions. So when you stand up and do what's right for students, we're going to be there to support you and back you up. But we want you to also remember, for you and your colleagues, that this is not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. This is a civil rights issue. There will be me and other students will be reaching out to our legislators to talk about what we believe is important and what needs to change in the education system. And in fact, I'll be back on Thursday here at the Capitol to talk to more of you. There are students on 13 campuses in Minnesota to fight for what's right for all kids. And we are going to do so with dedication and ferocity to make sure that we're fighting for social justice and an equitable education system. And we know that you will be too.
Thank you, Mr. Avon. I appreciate your testimony and you sharing your stories and all your efforts on behalf of yourself and other students. Any other questions or presenters?
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
May I ask Mr. Avon?
Senator Wieger.
Your testimony is just one of the most persuasive I've heard this session and maybe ever in terms of your life story, and that's just so inspiring. What's your dream after you graduate?
My dream is to go to law school. I'm not sure where yet, but to go to law school and maybe get involved with policy law is one of my thoughts, but I'm not exactly sure yet. Like I said, sophomore, 20 years old, still making those life decisions.
Excellent job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Avon, I think that you bring a very powerful message about the issue of resources and policy. I think that in the policy committee in education, we're having that conversation right now. We definitely believe that we need to invest resources in education, and that resources are critical right now because we have defunded a lot of programs. But we have a significant problem in terms of really understanding how we can use the few resources we have now effectively. So tell me about, I'm very curious about your experience with counseling and how counselors were part of your life. It seems like we have a lot of resources available. You know, I have a kid who just graduated from high school and another who is going to graduate soon.
Right.
And like you, they are motivated to continue and have the opportunities, and we are part of their lives trying to figure out, you know, what is next for them. But how do we incorporate into this model of education a system that can keep track of people like you who and everyone, really, to see what is the next step? What do you see as a good model out there? Do we have counselors that are effective, that are tracking kids and saying, you know, this is the next thing for you, this is what is available for you, no matter where you are in your, you know, journey in high school?
Mr. Abon.
All right. So thank you for the question. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. Speaking on behalf of myself and not our all the students in Minnesota, I think that counselors need to play a huge role. And I'm not sure necessarily if we're providing enough support for all of our students, because I think we think a lot about the teacher-to-student ratio, but we don't necessarily always think about the counselor-to-student ratio. There's a lot of students and a very few counselors. And so there are a lot of problems at home that students may need to deal with. And just for myself too, like I needed my counselor a lot to help me with a lot of college admission stuff. And so my counselor was extremely helpful with that and helping me figure all of that stuff out with all the different applications and all the different processes, and really helping me get to where I am today at the University of Minnesota. So I think we need to start thinking about providing more resources and more counselors in schools so that students can create more meaningful relationships with their counselors, so they feel more open and more willing to go to their counselors when they have any problems or any troubles.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great testimony, great compelling story about the compare and contrast and what a system we have that needs to be fixed. And I heard from this committee talk about where Minnesota ranks among the student-to-counselor ratio, and, you know, we're close to being dead last, and I think it's well worth a deeper discussion. And also, Mr. Chair, if you'd let me go back to the school nurse discussion that Ms. Sandvig brought forward. And one of the things I think it's really worth our time and effort is we look at third-party paying, whether it's the school-linked mental health services bill that's out there. We're really going to look at those third-party payers. If the system is broke regarding the duplicative services, I think we would benefit to spend some time looking at it. And here's why. We know that a licensed school nurse brings 68% of the funding if they're going to be part of an evaluation or assessment. They're able to do that. If you're not a licensed school nurse, it's about 40%. I might be off by a couple percentage points, but it's real. It's real there. 8 years ago, my own district that I represented used to bill about $10,000 a year in third-party paying. Last year, we were able to recoup $1.8 million just because we fixed the system. And it was really advocating that we're doing medically related services. If there's duplication within the two different systems with health and human services and education, I would like us to really investigate how we can make that system a lot more efficient and easier, not in a sense easier, but more efficient for folks to get the services to the students. If that would be okay, Mr. Chair.
thank you, Senator Hoffman. I think duly noted, and some good points there made. Thank you, Mr. Abon.
Thank you.
There's no other presenters. Senator Wieger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Our next meeting, as noted on the agenda, will be this Thursday. It's a joint meeting with the House, 8:15, 15 minutes earlier. But remember, we're done by 9:45 or so. And we're going to hear on the Integration Aid Task Force. lot of work's gone into that. It's reflected in the budget. So, and we have Scott Thomas, who co-chaired that. He's flying in from Washington, I believe, on his own dime. And we have other testifiers as well. So I hope you can be at that meeting. We're also looking at a joint meeting on special education once we get further details from the audit and some additional scheduling details that we have to work out. For the record, we don't have any bills in our division yet. So, but we've been getting a lot of background overviews, which is what we should be doing at this point. But there will be a flurry of activity in the next several weeks, I guarantee that. Several bills have gone to Senator Ray's committee with policy implications, but there's financial as well. So this will, and we will be multitasking as we have an overlap of membership, so we'll be looking into many of these areas that we've heard about in the policy committee, but it will come back here. For the department, we've had the overview. We've heard on the work group on education finance reform, but the department has its budget proposal. We did get that overview, and last meeting I mentioned the budget books. I assume you all took that home over the weekend, but no, it's right here, and if you'd like to maybe just start with a few pages and go through that, and I encourage you to contact the department, or there's a resource person if you want to delve into that. We can do it at the committee table as well, and will, but you can use this time as well to look into particular areas. And it's spelled out in the budget, and if it's not there, just let the department or our staff know. We believe that the department will have a bill introduced formally very soon. And tentatively, we would look at hearing that next Thursday. So that would be good prep. Heads up for looking at the budget. And again, this is tentative. We're assuming that the timetable works, that it could be on the 14th or Valentine's Day. The 13th, next Wednesday, is school lunch day, I believe, and we're trying to schedule all bills relating to school lunch, nutrition. I believe there's at least three, four that have been put in, and this is just an announcement, and we have an email that is going through to other authors to let them know if you do have something on that subject, especially let us know, because we'd like to include that for that hearing. And usually the cooks and others from your district will be here that day, so we want to try to let them be here when we actually discuss something directly related to what they're doing. So that's overall where we're at. As I mentioned, and you're all aware, we will hear our February forecast later in the month, and I would expect we'll have targets in terms of amount of revenue that we're looking at for spending in early March, and then rolling up our sleeves, putting that bill together in March in terms of a lot of these concepts that we've talked about. There'll be often we'll refer to a bill and then lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, be discussions individually, et cetera. And then we anticipate after the April break, early April, that we'll have a proposal that we'll be sharing with you. And then it makes its journey through the committee, through the full finance committee, tax committee, of course, and then to the floor, and then ultimately to conference committee in May, or late April or early May. So that's the big picture. Any questions, Senator?
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wiger, do you know offhand, are all of the education bills that are, they're intermingled with spending or have some spending implications, are they all going to Senator Therese Ray's committee and then to the Finance Committee, or do we know?
Senator Wiger?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, Most of the bills are going to Senatoris Reyes, as many finance bills will have the implication of policy, but we did hear the all-day kindergarten and Senator Kent's bill, and we, you know, so it goes through the leadership office, but Senator Cohen makes that call on the referral.
Mr. Chairman. So the track of that bill, once it's introduced, if it's strictly policy, it doesn't go to Senator Cohen, it goes to Senator Therese Reyes, because that's outside of the finance.
Senator, if I may.
Ms. Helling?
If it is a policy bill, it will be sent to Senator Pappas's office. The referral will be made there to policy. And if it has finance implications, depending upon what the bill has in it, if there's some policy that has to be decided on and there's finance, then it'll start with education policy, and then it'll have to be referred, depending upon what they do there, have to be referred back to the Finance Committee. And I remind members, if you have a bill that is sent to education policy and then it is referred to education finance, you have to have another bill hearing request put in to the Finance Committee to send it to division. And so that's kind of the track of the way the bills are going at this point.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Senator Stump.
Just to help members clarify in their own mind, let's say if you change the weighting on a pupil unit, I mean, that's a policy decision, but it's really a finance issue. Does that end up in Senator Therese Reyes' committee?
Ms. Helling?
I'm not sure. I would think that it might, but it just seems to be depending upon how the bills are what the language is in the bill. There is a nutrition bill that makes a policy change, but it has about a $4 million financial impact, and that bill has been referred to the policy committee for discussion on that policy, and then it will be referred to us.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm sorry I'm late today. Came in from Northfield this morning, 2 hours and 20 minutes, normally a 50-minute drive, and I missed the Rural Caucus, and I had 36 pastry items in my my back seat. And so I'm telling the members here, and 3:17, you could probably find a donut or a roll. So, with that, meeting adjourned.
Is this on TV?